British Public Radio. Nature.
This week, the world's highest altitude radio telescope opens in Chile.
Because ALMA is so big and so sensitive here on top of the world, it can reach back to the earliest galaxies, 10 billion years ago.
And the biology behind the new SARS-like virus.
For this virus, if it is spread from human to human, which we can't quantify currently, then it probably has an open field.
Plus, how painkillers from the same family as aspirin could improve the success of stem cell transplants. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith. This week, the world's most sophisticated radio telescope will open its doors. The Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA, is perched 5,000 metres above sea level in the high deserts of Chile. It should be powerful enough to reveal never-before-seen details of the universe. Nature's US news editor Eric Hand travelled to ALMA. And in his final appearance on the Nature podcast, Jeff Brumfield caught up with Eric in the Washington office to discuss the telescope project and what it will see.
The first question I wanted to ask you is just, I mean, describe what it's like seeing ALMA for the first time.
It's quite a sight to behold. First, you have to get there. It's at 5,000 meters. And what's surprising is you'd expect being at 5,000 meters, you'd be at the top of a mountain, but here you are on a very flat plateau at the top of the world. And filling this plateau are what will soon be 66 dishes, huge white dishes of carbon fiber and steel filling this volcanic plain.
I imagine it looks kind of like, I don't know, I was thinking about this morning, the set from a sci-fi movie or something like that.
Yeah, it is surreal. I think I described in my story that these things looked like heads on Easter Island. You know, they're so big and out of place.
And so what are they doing there?
Astronomers are using these dishes to go after cold dust and gas. They're not observing starlight directly. These are akin to radio telescope dishes, and they're looking at the faint emanations from cold dust and gas that surrounds stars and surrounds galaxies or is embedded within galaxies. And because ALMA is so big and so sensitive here on top of the world, it can reach back to the earliest galaxies, you know, 10 billion years ago.
What do you think is one of the most exciting potential observations it could do?
I think there will be two major impacts, one very near to hand and the other very distant. Closer to home will be its investigations of circumstellar disks, the dust and gas around stars. And I think they will be able to see stars in the act of forming and even the planets forming around these stars and understand the flows of gas better than they've ever done before. And that's because ALMA has this incredible ability to resolve things. Because the dishes can be spaced so widely, it can have this extra resolution and see very fine detail in these star systems. The other science case is the very distant universe. ALMA will have 66 dishes, most of them 15 meters across, and that allows them to collect so many photons that even these faint galaxies from the very beginning of the universe, the array will be able to collect signals from these earliest galaxies.
Now, in addition to writing about the incredible discovery potential of ALMA, I mean, you also write quite a bit in this article about how the telescope got built. Tell me a little about that.
Yeah, ALMA is interesting. It is truly the world's most international observatory in astronomy. Never before have this many nations tried to do something together like this, and it was a pain. There were three main partners that allowed ALMA to get built: North America, mostly the US, Europe, and Japan, and they all went to their own contractors, and they all had their own dishes built to the same specifications. But they all had their own little unique twists that, unless you were looking carefully, you wouldn't even notice.
And so what is the consequence of that, having these three slightly different versions of the same instrument? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's a good thing in that ALMA actually got built, and these countries, these three partners, could route the money needed to build these dishes back to contractors in their own nations. The bad thing is it means that there's an extra level of complexity. You'll need different parts on hand to keep these dishes maintained. You'll need experts who know how to maintain them, three different sets of experts to maintain them. And it just adds to a level of operations complexity that will add to the annual operations cost.
So, I mean, Almond's at 5,000 meters, right? Which is incredibly high up. What's it like to drive up to that site? And I mean, what do you experience?
Alma is very high up, 5,000 meters. This is higher than Mauna Kea in Hawaii. This is, I think, about the same height as base camp at the foot of Mount Everest. And you're already in a desert, in the Atacama Desert. You're already dehydrated and dry. In the ride to the top, you carry little cans of pressurized oxygen so you can take a squirt in your mouth if you're feeling too lightheaded. And the people working at the top and driving up to the top and down all are required to have oxygen tubes in their noses.
Did you have trouble taking notes?
I did.
Coming up in the research highlights, why it's difficult to breed crops that can cope with salt, plus ancient camels in the Arctic. Yes, you heard that right. But first, here's Thea with a simple boost for cell therapies.
Patients suffering from blood disorders like leukemia or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma can be treated with bone marrow transplants. That's because the bone marrow is one source of blood stem cells. To carry out a transplant, doctors usually use drugs to move the stem cells from the donor's bone marrow to the blood, where they can be more easily tapped. However, a chemical messenger called prostaglandin E has other ideas. It tethers stem cells in the bone marrow so they don't wander off. Now a team led by Lewis Pellis at the Indiana University School of Medicine in the US have found a way around this by using painkillers. They've discovered that anti-inflammatory drugs from the same family as aspirin and ibuprofen inhibit prostaglandin E and let the cells break free. I phoned Lewis, who knows more about prostaglandins than most people.
I've been looking at a molecule called prostaglandin E, for instance, since the 1970s. And this is in a regulatory network that controls a variety of things in the body. If you actually think of everything that an aspirin can do, now you can understand that everything that prostaglandin is mediating, because what aspirin and most of these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs do is block the enzymes that make prostaglandins. So prostaglandin is associated with pain, it's associated with fever, it's associated with inflammation, it can regulate blood pressure, it has roles in fertility, it's involved in a variety of things. And my work back from as early as the early to mid-1970s was showing that this molecule can play a role in regulating the production of stem cells.
And more specifically, prostaglandin is retaining these blood stem cells in the bone marrow. So how does an anti-inflammatory drug like aspirin influence that?
Well, what the drug is doing is blocking prostaglandin production. That's all these drugs do. Therefore, this retentive mechanism decreases, and therefore the cells are more available. And when they're more available, their inherent pathway is to migrate out of the bone marrow.
Not only did you test this in mice, but you also looked at this inhibition in humans and baboons as well.
Correct, yes. So it was a very simple test. I mean, we gathered up a bunch of volunteers. They took one pill a day. And this is, you know, meloxicam is what we use. It's an FDA-approved drug. We took some blood before, we took some blood after, and we measured stem and progenitor cells in the blood. And after 5 days, what we saw in these normal volunteers was exactly what we saw in baboons and exactly what we saw in mice. We find more of them in the blood after taking the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug.
Patients have been taking these anti-inflammatory drugs, or aspirin-like drugs, for decades. Why haven't we seen this before?
Because we don't see a long-term change in blood production. Okay? This is a very transient or short-term mechanism. We can give the drug for 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, almost 7 days, and we still see this effect. When we give it beyond that, it's gone. Either the cells become insensitive to this, or they just reset, and we don't get this mobilization or egress function anymore. So we can only use this very transiently. And when most patients are on these drugs, they're on them chronically. So one of the things we're currently speculating is, why is low-dose aspirin so effective? You know, the doses of low, that they call low-dose aspirin are the same kind of doses that we see this effect occurring. You know, aspirin is a wonder drug, isn't it? And it continues to astound us as to the number of things that it can do.
And how might the drug you've tested here, meloxicam, improve the success of transplants that are currently given to patients?
Clinically, when we do a transplant, we don't use bone marrow. We use what we call mobilized peripheral blood. We give a drug, and that drug is called Neupogen or granulocyte colony stimulating factor. It is a hematopoietic hormone. It will move stem and progenitor cells from the bone marrow into the blood, so that most transplants done today are using that regimen. Now, to do a transplant, one must get enough stem and progenitor cells. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, especially with patients with multiple myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, we can't meet that target. So there are numerous patient populations through which we think that if we can get more stem cells, the outcomes will be better.
And just finally, now we know that these drugs have this sort of effect, how long do you think it might be before we can apply that clinically?
This is an FDA-approved drug, meloxicam. Neupogen, or G-CSF, is an FDA-approved drug. Giving Neupogen to patients with multiple myeloma or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is standard of care for a transplant. Okay? All we would be doing is adding a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, and we don't need any approval to do this. So we are going to start accruing patients, and we are going to start testing this.
Lewis Pellis at the Indiana University School of Medicine.
Coming up, we review 50 years of research on the brightest objects in the universe. But now for the research highlights with Noah Baker.
Farmers might have an easier time growing crops if what they plant could thrive on salty land. Breeding salt-tolerant crops is a challenge, but it turns out that the trait has evolved many times in wild grasses, the family that most crops belong to. Researchers at the Australian National University in Canberra looked at the family trees of over 2,000 grasses. They saw over 70 independent instances where salt tolerance had evolved. So if evolution has made salt-tolerant crops, why aren't we better at it? The team say it might be because cultivated plants have little genetic diversity. Read that study in Biology Letters. Camels have humps to help them survive the heat and wide, flat feet for walking on sand. But these traits may not have evolved in the desert. Researchers at the Canadian Museum of Nature in Ottawa found a fossilised leg bone in the Canadian Arctic. It dates back almost 3.5 million years, a time when the region was warmer than it is now and covered with forests. When the researchers analysed protein that had been preserved in the bone, they discovered it came from an extinct giant camel. This is the furthest north camel fossils have ever been found. The team suggests ancient camels might have evolved traits to survive the cold Arctic forests, their humps to store fat, and their feet to walk on snow. Find that study in Nature Communications.
Coming up in the news, we'll be hearing about the newest coronavirus and its pandemic potential. But before that, Noah Baker revisits the discovery of the universe's brightest objects.
50 years ago, astrophysicist Martin Schmidt published a paper in Nature describing the first distance measurement to a peculiar object far, far away. The paper describes it as
3C273, a star-like object with large redshift.
This hugely bright, star-like thing at the edge of the universe was the first quasar to be discovered. Quasars lie at the heart of galaxies, created from the gas and stars that fall into supermassive black holes. 50 years on from the first report, in a comment piece this week in Nature, Robert Antonucci of the University of California, Santa Barbara, talks about Schmidt's seminal discovery and how far we've come in our understanding.
I guess the story begins after World War II, when people started making maps of the sky using radio telescopes instead of optical telescopes for the first time. And the sky looks totally different at radio wavelengths and optical wavelengths.
Schmidt analyzed one of these radio telescope-derived objects and its surrounding materials.
Spectra of the star were taken with the prime focus spectrograph. They show a number of broad emission features on a rather blue continuum.
When you see spectral features, emission lines in particular, then you can determine, among other things, their velocity with a Doppler shift. And when objects are moving away from us very rapidly in the distant universe, well, that's an indication of the distance.
The Doppler shift, known as redshift, which Schmidt discovered in the spectrum, indicated an object far more distant than anything observed before.
The unprecedented identification of the spectrum of an apparently stellar object in terms of a large redshift suggests the distance would be around 500 megaparsecs.
Plus, in order to see something so far away, it must be unbelievably bright.
The stellar object is a nuclear region of a galaxy. The nuclear region would be 100 times brighter optically than the luminous galaxies which we have identified with radio sources thus far.
These super powerful quasi-stellar objects at the edge of the universe would revolutionize astronomy. Antonucci describes the discovery as the end of our scientific childhood.
These objects were so powerful that they could be seen a large fraction of the way to the so-called cosmic horizon. Now, the universe is 14 billion light years across, and that means if we look at an object 13 billion light years away, then we're seeing the object as it was when the universe was only 1 billion years old. And we knew that in principle we could see the early universe, but that was just a dream until the quasars came along. Until then, we had been restricted to a little space-time playpen.
It's 50 years since Schmidt's paper. So how much do we know now about quasars?
The answer is not a great deal more than we knew in 1963. And I find that pretty sad. I was a grad student in the early 1980s. I don't feel like I know too much more about quasars than I did then.
But what's the holdup? Antonucci suggests the problem lies deeper than merely in the difficulty of the science.
So there's no question that it's an extremely difficult problem, but a lot of the effort put into studying quasars has been wasted because people stick to ideas long after they've been disproven. Many, or even most, of the theoretical papers on quasars today have been ruled out by the time they're published.
Antonucci points the finger at a group of theories that assume quasars form in the same way as much smaller bodies, with materials spiraling around a central point, in the case of quasars, a black hole. These are called accretion disk models, and are very popular in astronomy. But Antonucci claims that oversimplified versions of these models just don't cut it when it comes to explaining quasars. Why then would astronomers stick with a broken model?
Well, you know, that's baffled me since graduate school. I don't know. In 1985, 2 years after the first standard accretion disk models were made, the fundamental assumption of those models was falsified. And so if the fundamental assumption of your model is wrong, I don't know. I think history says that maybe in a few cases it doesn't matter, and you might have captured, you know, some of the essential physics. But the thing about these models is they have no predictive power whatsoever. And prediction is the difference between science and pseudoscience.
A good lesson for all scientists, perhaps. In the meantime, Antonucci urges his colleagues to think hard about the models they use. The answer, he suggests, lies in critical thinking, but perhaps less blue sky and more black hole.
Remember the SARS outbreak back in the early 2000s? There were thousands of confirmed cases, a tenth of them fatal. SARS was caused by a coronavirus, a type of infection that isn't usually worse than a cold. But that doesn't stop researchers from keeping an eye on new versions, and they've spotted what they think might be a nasty one. In Nature this week is a report on the biology of the new human coronavirus. Declan Butler has written a news story about it. Declan, some background first. Tell me a bit more about what this virus is exactly and when it first appeared.
Right, well, it's a novel, what we call a coronavirus. This is a family of viruses. They're actually called coronaviruses because under the microscopes, their spikes on their surface look like a corona or a halo. In fact, they're quite pretty under the microscope. And it's actually the coronavirus family of viruses are mostly, you know, a set of viruses that usually don't cause anything worse than the common cold. Now, the exception, of course, was the SARS virus, severe acute respiratory syndrome it caused. And although the SARS virus was deadly, in fact, the receptors for that virus were deep in the lungs, which meant that while it caused serious disease, it didn't actually transmit as easily as many people think. It wasn't that contagious. And some people suspect that the receptor for the novel coronavirus shows very similar behaviour.
Now, we'll have Christian Drosten, one of the authors of the new paper, on in just a second to talk about that receptor a little bit more. First of all, though, where did this new virus come from? Where did it sort of start?
The first time we detected it was last officially in September in Saudi Arabia, although people have been working on it over the summer. Although we now know that there were actually cases back in April last year in Jordan. So that was the first kind of cases. And since then, there have been 14 cases. And 8 of these people have died, mostly from severe respiratory disease, but also from kidney failure in some cases. So, you know, that apparent mortality rate is, you know, extraordinarily high, even though most virologists don't really believe it, as I'll probably get onto in a moment.
Declan, you mentioned the receptor there, and earlier this week I spoke to co-author of the paper, Christian Drosten, about this. So let's hear from him. I first asked him what parts of the virus enable it to infect humans.
Well, the investigation targeted the glycoprotein and the receptor it uses. So it's actually not a part of the virus, but a part of the human cells that allows the virus to attach and to be taken up into the cell. And we know the surface glycoprotein, the big spike protein of the coronaviruses, this is always the protein that coronaviruses use to bind to the cell surface via some unknown receptor.
So it's the receptor in humans that it's targeting that's the new thing about this virus, if you like.
Yes, I mean, the virus is new too. We know it since September, but now there is also a new receptor molecule of which we know it has some functions. So it's not a new protein to researchers, but the function to serve as the entry receptor for this new virus. Obviously, that's the new thing about it.
Now, in your lab, you must come across a lot of emerging viruses. I mean, it's what you guys do. How does this one match up? Are you any more interested in it or concerned by it than any other viruses you see pass through the lab?
Well, I mean, if you compare this against other emerging viruses, you have those viruses that you know they are really very exotic and they will probably just be transmitted, say, upon very, very close contact. While this one, as a coronavirus, should be transmitted through the air from human to human. And if this is the case, if this is really a human-to-human transmission scenario, then obviously the problem of population immunity comes into play. And here we can say, and this we could say very early on, humans don't have any antibodies against this virus. There is no population immunity.
And does that give you cause for concern?
Yes, this is a cause of concern, obviously. I mean, the reason why we don't have an influenza pandemic every year is that we have population immunity. The virus will always encounter somebody who is already immune and where it can't cause a new infection. And for this virus, if it is spread from human to human, which we can't quantify currently, but if, then it probably has an open field. This is the one essential part of the equation that you need for a pandemic, absence of population immunity. And this is a box we can tick. While the other box that we still don't know whether we can tick it is how effective the virus is transmitted.
Back to you, Declan Butler. The virus so far, as you said, has infected 14 people and 8 of those have died at a pretty high rate. In your story, you look at whether this virus has the potential to become an outbreak. I mean, it has virologists worried, does it?
It's actually far too soon to say. What we can say is that, you know, when we see a virus which transmits between humans and even slightly, and actually causes severe respiratory disease, that's always concerning. Now, what we have so far is that we have seen some human clusters, and human clusters of cases within families often suggests that, in fact, human-to-human transmission is happening. Now, you can also get clusters because actually everybody was exposed to the same source. So it's very, very difficult to actually decipher these. But last month in the United Kingdom, we had a cluster of three cases, the first one of whom had travelled to Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And then he came back, and it seems very clear that he transmitted the disease to two relatives who had not any travel history. So that really confirms that some human-to-human transmission is happening. At the same time, in that UK cluster and in other clusters, health authorities have tracked down all the different contacts of those infected people, and none of them were infected, even after testing hundreds of contacts. All that suggests that the virus is actually quite difficult to transmit, so that's the good news.
What extra help will the information about the receptor be?
The receptor is really key to many, many aspects of understanding the actual virus. One is, if we work out the receptor distribution in the respiratory tract, if, for example, all those receptors, as it looks pretty likely, are in the lower parts of the lung, that would actually, you'd predict from that that in fact you would have serious disease, but it would be very hard to transmit because in fact there wouldn't be any latched onto the nose and the throat where it could be coughed or sneezed out. Now, in the case of SARS, that was exactly what happened. The receptors were all in the deep part of the lung, and so that was exactly why it was hard to transmit. So it can give you key information like that.
More on that story and lots more news and features goodies at nature.com/news.
Join us again next week when we'll hear about science's longest running experiments. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith.